Abraham, Elijah, Peter, Pontius Pilate. What do these four men have in common? All of them allowed fear to determine their course of action in at least one instance. Abraham lied to Pharaoh in Egypt. He lied to Abimelech and Gerar. Elijah fled from Jezebel in fear. Peter denied the Lord. Pilate feared the people. Fear dominates many people. It's their only consideration and deciding many things. One talent man lamented, "I was afraid," and he got busy digging. Gideon released all who were fearful and afraid. Judges chapter 7. No concern for honor, no concern for duty, no concern for loyalty. They were all afraid, so they ran home. Fear before duty is cowardice, and it produces an ugly mess in actions and in character. God told the Israelites that when they entered Canaan, if they turned away from serving him, he would send faintness into their hearts. He said, "The sound of a shaken leaf will cause you to flee. You shall flee as though fleeing from a sword, and you shall fall when no one pursues. You shall stumble over one another when no one pursues, and you shall have no power to stand before your enemies." Leviticus 26, 36, and 37. Many people wish they were fearless. They presume that is the fabric of heroes. But that's not really the case. Fearlessness is not a virtue. It requires no character at all to face something that you don't dread. Anybody here afraid of this podium? Afraid of the pew you're sitting on? One who is completely fearless is either grossly ignorant or a fool. Alexander Pope wrote the poem in 1711, "Fools rush in where angels fear to tread." Quote from this morning, Oswald Chambers, an evangelist, died in 1917, said, "When you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you do not fear God, you fear everything else." This is true, sort of. The Apostle Paul endured social rejection. He endured prison, beatings. He endured stonings, impending death. And we might think of him as a fearless iron man. But that's really quite inaccurate. For example, in Acts chapter 18, Paul had gone to Corinth after being in Athens, and he was alone. Timothy and Silas finally came from Macedonia to Paul. Acts chapter 18 and verse 5, we're told. And then Paul, we're told, was constrained, forced, compelled, urged, coerced by the Spirit. And he testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. Acts 18, verse 5. Why did he wait till Timothy and Silas arrived? Why did he have to be compelled by the Spirit? Why did God have to tell him in verse 9 of that same chapter, "Do not be afraid, but speak. Do not keep silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to hurt you, for I have many people in this city." Likely referring to the same incident, Paul told the Corinthians themselves in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 3, "I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling." title of this lesson is, I Will Not Fear. Lack of fear is not necessarily that which is to be desired. Rather, courage to overcome fear is the desirable attribute. And I'm having real fun with my PowerPoint this evening. I'll just ignore it if you'll do the same. How do we develop this kind of courage? Courage to overcome fear regardless of what's going on around us. I'm going to suggest three ways. We must learn to fear God more than we fear anything else. We must develop a faith in God that is strong enough to put fear in its proper perspective. And third, we must mature in our love for God to the extent that our love displaces or casts out fear. Fear is a crippling enemy. We all have fears. As God's people, we must develop the courage to overcome our fears so that we can better serve the Lord. Fear tempers fear. A number of years ago, a professional photographer by the name of Eric Volley was hanging by a nylon rope from a 395-foot cliff in Nepal. Nepal is south of China, south of the Himalayas, between the Himalayas and India. Nearby on a rope was a man by the name of Mani Lal. He was doing what he'd done for decades. He was hunting honey. The Himalayan cliffs, or foothills, the cliffs shelter honeycombs of the world's largest honeybee. And at that moment, there were thousands surrounding and swarming both men. Mani Lal was as calm as ever. He had survived hundreds of attacks. But Eric Volley, the photographer, described that moment in National Geographic. He said, "There were so many bees, I was afraid I was going to freak out. But I knew if I did, I'd be dead. So I took a deep breath and relaxed. Being stung would be better than finding myself at the bottom of the cliff." He overcame his fears. He won a photo competition for his efforts, but more important, he overcame his fears and he stayed alive. He fought fear with fear. His fear of falling tempered. His fear of falling soothed his fear of the bees. You have fear being overridden by a greater fear, a terrifying, almost numbing fear being revoked by a greater fear. Somebody who's scared of spiders would gladly run to a basement or a cellar full of spiders to get rid of a raging bear who's after them, who's attacking them. A few spider bites are quite insignificant compared to being mauled by a bear. Matthew 10:28, Jesus said, "Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell." This is a not but construction. It emphasizes, do not fear those who kill the body. Next sentence, but fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell. Any normal person would be afraid of torture. Any normal person would be afraid of a violent death. Jesus is saying, fear God more than that. The only thing the Bible ever tells us to fear is God himself. Proverbs 1:7 and Proverbs 9:10, fear of God is the beginning of knowledge. Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. The best way to overcome fear of man is to fear God more than you fear man. And it's in this sense that faith puts fear in its perspective. Matthew 8, verses 23 through 27, gives the account of Jesus being with the disciples on the Sea of Galilee. A storm comes up. Storms are terrible in that area, from what I understand, as they come down over those mountains. wind whipping, waves pounding against the boat. They wake Jesus, and of all things, he says, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" Would you have been fearful? Probably. Would I have been fearful? Probably. But the problem here is that there was a failure to see the ruler of the universe in back of the storm. Faith sees the rest of the picture. It is the worldly who only see the here and now. Faith sees beyond the moment. Faith sees beyond the persecution, beyond the torture and death. Faith sees beyond the momentary financial or physical hardships. Faith sees beyond all those things, ultimately, to a resurrection. Hebrews chapter 11, the latter part, gives an account, or numerous accounts, references to lots of people who suffered in lots of ways for their faith. Verse 35 says, "Women received their dead, received back their dead, raised to life again. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection." Think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saying, "Our God can deliver us from you, O King Nebuchadnezzar, but even if he doesn't do so, we're going to let you know that we will not bow down to your idol." Faith sees our helper when we are helpless. Faith sees our invisible companions when we're alone. 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 8 through 17, it says, "Now the king of Syria was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, 'I will set up camp in such and such a place.' The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, 'Beware of passing that place because the Syrians are going down there.' So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. This enraged the king of Syria. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, 'Tell me, which one of us is on the side of the king of Israel?' One of his officers said, 'None of us, my lord, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom.'" I love this response. The king ordered, "Go find out where he is so I can send men and capture him." That's funny. He knows what you're thinking even in your bedroom. But somehow he's going to miss this. The report came back saying he is in Dothan. Verse 14, "Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night, surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God, when Elisha's servant, got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city." "Oh no, my lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "Open his eyes, Lord, so that he may see." Then the Lord opened the eyes of the servant. He looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Faith in God puts fear in its proper perspective. And last, I may just give up on this altogether. The PowerPoint, that is, for those who are listening to the audio. Love displaces fear. Love casts out, it supplants, it dislodges fear. 1 John 4:18 says, "There is no fear in love." The context here involves the day of judgment, verse 17 of that same chapter. Love has been perfected, the New International Version says, made complete. Love has been made complete or perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness or confidence, as the New International Version says, in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so are we in this world. I'll read this again without interjections. Love has been made complete among us in this, that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment or punishment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. Confidence or boldness in verse 17 is contrasted with fear in verse 18. If you have confidence and boldness, you have one attitude about things, particularly the judgment. If you don't have the love that's being described, you have fear. Perfect love casts out fear, verse 18. What is perfect love? We think of perfect, and too often we think sinless, perfection. More often than not, the word is used to mean mature or complete, as the New International Version translates it. Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 through 48 says, "You've heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect." One who truly loves his enemies, one who truly loves God to the extent that he gives up his own selfish ways, he gives up his own inclinations, is one who shall be perfect or complete, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. 1 John chapter 4, verse 17 seems to make a pretty good commentary on verse 18. Love has been perfected or made complete among us in this. Here's how it's made complete. That we may have boldness or confidence in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. We will be like our Father. That's what Jesus is saying in Matthew chapter 5. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 21 and chapter 2 verse 28 shed some light on this as well, because they use the same word that's translated boldness, unfortunately, in the New King James Version in chapter 4. Same word used in chapter 3 and chapter 2, and it's translated confidence. But I'll read both of those verses and see if that doesn't kind of help pull things together. Chapter 3, verse 21 of 1 John. "Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God." Chapter 2, verse 28. "Now, little children, abide in him, so that when he appears, we may have confidence and not be ashamed before him at his coming." Perfect love is that which motivates or induces obedience to the point that we are transformed into the image of Christ. It is that person who, in spite of their weaknesses, in spite of their shortcomings, in spite of their failures, has nothing to fear when considering the day of judgment, because they love God and they have been made like him. Loving God with all the heart, mind, soul, and strength will produce a life that will not fear the judgment. Loving God supremely, to say it another way, will bring about conduct that does not need to be anxious when considering the afterlife. Love of truth demands truth, and it will accept nothing less. Love of God compels worship. Love of what is right requires righteousness. Even if there were no hell, this kind of love would still obey. A man is challenged, his mouth is dry, his heart pounds. Cold sensation spreads over his body, knot balls up in his stomach. His muscles tremble, he has a strong inclination to be somewhere else, anywhere else. But he steps out, he meets his Goliath. The brave man feels the same fear as the coward, only he does not allow it to paralyze him. He does what must be done in spite of his fear. Courage is the sterling attribute. It is the alternate response to fear. Courage is the strength to face the detestable. Courage is the strength to do the dreadful. Courage chooses what is right in spite of the consequences. Courage puts duty before fear. Putting it in biblical perspective, courage is that which is brought about by fearing God more than anything else. This kind of courage is a product of faith in God. This kind of courage is a product of love for God. It is this courage, not lack of fear, that separated David from all the other people of Israel and enabled him to face Goliath. It is this courage, not lack of fear, that enabled the apostles in Acts chapter 4 and 5 to stand before the Sanhedrin and to speak boldly about Christ. And it is the lack of this kind of courage that caused the downfall of King Saul. When Saul had sinned in refusing to destroy the Amalekites, and Samuel finally squeezed the truth out of him regarding his disobedience, Saul revealed what really motivated him to disobey God. He said in 1 Samuel 15:24, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice." Hebrews 13:6 says, "The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" Proverbs 29:25 says, "The fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts the Lord shall be safe." Let's stand and sing the song together that's been chosen.